Welcome to Best Picture This, where it is always Oscar season. I'm Mike.
And I'm Brian. In this show, we reevaluate every Best Picture nominee from the 21st century and decide whether to keep it or kick it from its Oscar pedestal.
And today is the final film we're covering of 2009, another Best Picture nominee, the movie An Education. The director, Lorne Fershig. I think I got that right. Here's the trailer.
If I get to university, I'm going to read what I want and wear black.
Now that shows you're a rebel. They don't want that at Oxford.
No, they don't want people who can think for themselves.
Oh, of course they don't.
Hello, but I'm a music lover and I'm worried about your cellos. Jump in.
What's this?
Jenny's been sent some flowers from a chap. Thank you.
Listen, I'm glad I ran into you. What are you doing on Friday?
Nothing.
I won't allow it.
That's him. You got me
wrapped. Hello.
He didn't tell me he had a sister, Jenna.
What if I promised to have her back by 11:30?
Very impressive young man.
Danny, these are my friends, Helen and Danny. Shall we?
Sorry. That's all right. It's lovely, isn't it? If you want something, just get David to take you shopping.
In Paris, though, not here.
I'd love to. There's so much I want you to see. When we kiss.
How was your evening?
Best night of my life.
Oh my God.
Jenny's new boyfriend. He's not my new boyfriend.
You have no idea how boring everything was before I met you.
Go to Oxford no matter what, because if you don't, you'll break my heart.
My choice is to do something hard and boring for the rest of my life, or go to Paris and have fun.
I'd be careful if I were you, Jenny.
I don't need looking after, thank you very much.
They can be quite naughty sometimes.
Come on.
It's a funny world you people live in.
We're not clever like you, so we have to be clever in other ways, because if we weren't, there would be no fun.
All my life, I've been scared. I didn't want you to be scared.
I suppose you think I'm a ruined woman.
You're not a woman.
Action is character. If we never did anything, we wouldn't be anybody.
You sound very old and wise.
I feel old, but not very wise.
Is this movie anti-fun propaganda?
That's what I was just wondering. What kind of crimes do you like to commit for fun?
God, the list is long. I steal microphones from podcast studios.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that's my first one.
So this movie was nominated for Best Picture, Best Screenplay, Nick Hornby, and Best Actress, Carey Mulligan. And since Kathryn Bigelow was nominated for Best Picture for The Hurt Locker, this is the first time that two women were nominated for Best Picture nominees, Lone Sheriff.
It's so crazy.
I know.
In 2010.
Exactly. So it was made for $7.5 million, made 26.1 in the box office, 93 Rotten Tomatoes, 85 Metacritic. So on our episode today, we will discuss, we'll talk about, ask questions, do some trivia. And keep it or kick it.
This is not my first question, but it's probably the most important thing mm-hmm. we'll talk about today.
Mm-hmm. I like this already.
Is Peter Sarsgaard a BPTGIE? I think he is.
Interesting.
I mean, I don't want to show my hand too soon, but I think he is.
Interesting. I was thinking about the definition of BPTGIE. Best picture this, good in everything.
Good in everything,
for those obviously. Who haven't listened to every single episode, mm-hmm. shame on you. Go back to the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what is the definition? I was thinking that it needed to be at least a few examples within the block of time that we are studying here, from 2000 to 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, good in everything that I can remember off the top of my head, basically.
Yeah.
It's kind of what it is.
Yeah, it's not a very mathematical metric, but I think we make it work.
There's
we'll
some
talk
method,
about this
yeah.
more as we go, I'm sure.
So, your real question?
I do, unbelievably enough. So I do like this movie, but I feel like there are certain shortcuts that it takes, especially at the end, that feel written to me.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, I'm thinking, why did Carey Mulligan have to quit school 3 weeks before graduation just because she wanted to marry the BPTGIE Peter Sarsgaard, who is good in everything. So I guess my question
wouldn't you throw away your life to marry a BPTGIE?
I would finish the last 3 weeks of school. So is this a narrative cheat, do you think, just to set up her fall from grace? Or is it meant to speak more to the feeling of invincibility of youth? How did you read it?
Yeah, I mean, the ending of it is definitely problematic to me, this movie. Mm-hmm. I like it quite a bit for most of it.
Yeah.
And then this movie had a chance to be great, but it ends up being kind of good because the ending is a little bit weak like this.
Yeah,
and
there's
a lot of critics that said the same thing. One thing that I thought maybe was an explanation for it is it's based on a true story. The British journalist Lynn Barber wrote a 10-page memoir essay that was published in Granta, which is a really, you know, pretty prestige literary journal in England. So Nick Hornby liked it, wrote the screenplay based on it. And he did this interview with LA Times, talks about how he had so much freedom to do what he wanted because it had enough of the structure, but he could write all the dialogue because it was only 10 pages long and everything. But I was thinking about that aspect with this kind of problematic ending. Did he kind of have to go along with the true story, essentially? I don't know. I didn't read the essay, so I don't really know if that's how the essay ends. But the fact that she does these things, it almost had this ring of like, just like in a lot of true stories, is it a narrative cheat or is that really what happened? And sometimes the thrust of the narrative doesn't quite always line up with the true facts in the end. And then, you know, you end up with somewhat slightly less satisfying storytelling. Mm-hmm. So that's my,
you know, musing. My sort of platform on this idea that you got to do what's best for the mm-hmm. movie. And so whether it's this way in the essay, I don't really care because you're adapting it and you can make any changes you want once you're working within adaptation.
I'm not sure if that's what Nick Hornby was doing, but mm-hmm. that thought crossed my mind.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that it does contribute to the idea that as kids we kind of think that we're bulletproof, that we know everything, and I kind of hate to get caught up on plot mechanic. I think that that's kind of the most boring thing about any movie that we talk about is the way that the plot moves necessarily. I want to feel it. I don't really want to be thinking about it. Yeah. But in this case, I just think it contributes to an ending that feels toothless.
She starts to get like, Carey Mulligan's character gets all preachy talking to Emma Thompson's character. Mm-hmm. You know, like she says in the end, you've got to tell us why you're doing it.
Yeah,
you're educating
us. It's not enough
us.
Just to educate us anymore.
And when she says us, it's like, I am now officially talking about for my generation.
Yes.
I am now speaking to the establishment on behalf of my generation,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't feel earned at all in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what feels sort of like Nick Hornby is sort of like, I'm going to write this great line in. At least that's my uncharitable way of thinking of it because it's still a good movie. I mean, there's so much of it that I really like. This whole relationship as it unfolds, I think, is believable and kind of fun, but dangerous. And like, you know, there's a lot of subtext, which is, I think, all well done.
On the topic of subtext and on that quote, let me just piggyback and do both of my questions at once, sure. because I was going to talk about this next. So that quote, it's not enough to educate us anymore. You have to tell us why you're doing this. I saw this in 2010, mm-hmm. right after it came out.
I think I did too.
That's very, very soon after I graduated college. So I'm out, Great Recession's kind of at the peak, and I'm not—
This is in your fun employment stage.
This is fun employment, and I'm not finding work, and it's not fun.
Uh-huh.
So I see this movie, this line seems very relevant and very important to me, mm-hmm. even though it kind of obviously feels like this is a line where I'm going to hit the audience with something. This is like my thesis in a way. But watching it this time, I'm not sure that it is a thesis, because that line alone seems to be speaking toward the modern state of higher education in 2009, 2010. But I don't know if there's really anything else in this movie that does that is really interested exploring that issue. Did you?
No, I mean, she talks about going to Oxford throughout and like her father wants her to go and like, this is the only way to do it.
And yeah. Everything.
And there's the tension between whether you need to get an education or get married.
Yeah.
And you know, he kind of says, Alfred Molina, who is not a BPTGIE, by the way.
Because you hate him in Chocolat.
I don't really like him in anything that I've seen him in, honestly. Sorry, Alfred. But like, he comes around and says, oh, well, if you're going to marry the guy, then that's fine if you don't go to Oxford. Because yep. In the end, really what mattered was that you got married, not that you got the education.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's some interesting tension there. Like, she's asking herself somewhat why, but... She loves, I mean, she seems like an intellectually curious person. She mm-hmm. happens to love art, but that doesn't mean like she doesn't like an education.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It felt a little bit disjointed, that whole kind of rant at the end.
Yeah, especially because she gets into this problem. She has her fall from grace, and then she's able to rectify everything pretty much immediately without any real problems.
Yeah. I guess I'll then study and then I'll just get into it.
She realizes her life would be worse without a degree. So as far as a modern conversation with higher ed, I'm not really sure that it's doing that. It seems a lot more interested in a woman's path to independence and autonomy in the 60s. You know, a degree means options.
Right, right.
And that I can understand.
Which seems like that's what her father was trying to do for her.
Yes, yes. And that idea is interesting. I'm on board mm-hmm. with that. But then all of a sudden it feels like this timely subtext becomes text all of a sudden. And it was the one and only time that happened. And rewatching, that was still the only line that I remembered clearly from this movie. So I was always kind of grappling with, are there other things going on here that make this movie a little more timely? And I'm not seeing them now. Or is that just a one-off? And I think it might be a one-off.
Yeah. Keith Ulick of Time Out, he wrote, Lone Schoenfig, directs it all as if it were a breezy lark. So a third act tonal shift makes for an incongruous, excessively moralistic fit with everything that's preceded. Most insulting, though, is the way in which the climactic passages miraculously tidy up every frayed edge of Jenny's life, unquote. Yeah. Again, that may be a little bit overstating it. He gave like one of the most negative reviews that I saw, which is usually what we do on this show, is read the most negative reviews we can find.
I don't know about that.
And then kind of, you know, say, well, it's not that bad.
And they don't really, they don't explain either how she kind of went from being out on the street metaphorically to she talked to the teacher and then it's fine, you know, just montage. Now we're at Oxford.
We should do a show about the best montages of all time.
Yeah, I'm down for that, I think.
Something Nick Hornby said to the LA Times article was, she's a suburban girl who's frightened that she's going to get out of everything that she's going to get cut out of everything good that happens in the city. That to me is a big story in popular culture. It's the story of pretty much every rock and roll band. Unquote.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was pretty interesting that he brings in a rock and roll band. So I'm thinking, what are the other examples of this kind of small, get out of the small town, I have to get out into the big city? And the first thing I thought of was It's a Wonderful Life. I thought of A Bug's Life, of course.
Two great
those are kind of the
of
two together, you know, the A and the B side of the same coin, if you will. I don't know if it's maybe also the prodigal son story. In a way, from the Bible,
I guess so.
But that I do kind of like the idea that's what Nick Hornby's thinking about, is like this. It is a universal story. It feels like. I mean, it's also hyper specific about these characters and, you know, putting the cello in the back seat and walking alongside. That's a great scene. I think that. I love how he talks about every rock and roll band. I guess it made me also think of Almost Famous because of that in a way. But do you see a similarity with It's a Wonderful Life here?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's almost just more concerned with exploration as an idea, whereas this is kind of almost stuck in that not really American Beauty 1999 headspace, but still sort of in the general, under the general umbrella of the suburbs equal death. Like mm-hmm. the only way to live a true authentic life is to be somewhere urban. You have to be in a city to do that. It's impossible to do it anywhere else. And I think that It's a Wonderful Life has a little bit of that, but it's just more about not wanting to sacrifice the richness of travel. Whereas this is not really concerned with travel.
I think part of the issue with this is like Carey Mulligan's character is it seems like she equates getting out of the small town with, like we were talking about before, fun. Mm-hmm. Like she loves art because it's entertaining and fun. She wants to go to nice restaurants and she wants to go listen to jazz music. But it's mostly, it seems like, because she likes to just play and have fun, which makes her quest feel a little bit less noble.
I don't know. Well, not even less noble, but just the fact that it's associated so closely with this band of like criminals.
Yeah.
It can't be that they live in the city and have a successful, normal life and just do artistic things and they're not tied down by like kids and domesticity. It can't mm-hmm. be that. It has to be that they're stealing paintings from people or yeah. maps or whatever.
Because they're kind of like basically these empty people that don't really have anything going for them. They just also are, you know, how can I have more fun? Well, I have to steal things to make yeah. to then fund my fun.
But wouldn't it be more interesting if they weren't cheaper like that? You
yeah.
know, if they were just sort of normal people who lived a different kind of life.
If they really did know C.S. Lewis and talk to him.
Yeah. Or if they just jet-set it to Paris on a weekend. I mean, yeah. there's no reason that a non-criminal can't do that. But I think the movie bridging the gap between like people who have fun and people who break the law are kind of the same people. Like, let's be honest here, right? Like the only real like wholesome life is back at home in like your dreary apartment with your parents.
I think that there's also an underlying danger and kind of like, mm-hmm. you know, a little bit scary this whole time because Peter Sarsgaard is so much older than she is.
Yeah.
You know, she's like, you know, 16, 17, whatever. And so it doesn't really matter how charming and, you know, how fun he can be and how much he's kind of like fawning over her. The fact that he's so much older, it's like, I don't know. I thought that was well done as far as like, it was never overtly addressed.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, we as the audience know something that maybe not only does she not really understand, but it seems like the parents were kind of willing to overlook.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was 1961, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's a really interesting kind of device, I thought. The danger that is mostly in our minds watching it in 2010 or 2022, whenever, 2023. But that brings me to like this other question. What is your reaction to this? I read the A.O. Scott review of it, and he was mostly favorable. But thought again, like a lot of people, that the ending seemed to be kind of weak and a little flimsy. And, but I thought this was really strange. At the very end of this review, it says in italics, like it's not part of the review, it says an education is rated PG-13. And then it says its sexual implications are not as troubling as they should be. As though that were part of the rating. Like,
yeah.
Like that's not in his review. Uh-huh. It's just like, you can see it at this theater. By the way, the sexual implications of this movie are not as troubling as they should be.
Do you agree with that?
Well, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, I think generally that's why I felt this sense of dread throughout mm-hmm. the movie. You know, it's just like an American Beauty, essentially. Like there's something wrong with this middle-aged guy going yeah. after this teenager. That's basically what's happening in this movie. The same thing.
Yeah.
And in American Beauty, it's like, it's a lot, it's very dark and sinister, this whole relationship. And it's also a lot different tone. Like there's kind of like there's a little bit of a campiness to it.
Yeah. There's a lot of differences between the two, but you're still dealing with sort of an inappropriate age gap.
Yeah.
And while watching this, I watched with Rebecca, my wife, and you know, she's like, how old are we supposed to think he is? You know, she was very hung up on it, which I think is good. But at the same time,
you're like, come on.
because
come
it's
on, babe, just get over
because
that.
It's not rated R or something. Like, it never really crosses a line, so it always kind of keeps you teetering where you don't know, should I be thinking that they're only like 5 years apart, or are they like 15 or what?
It doesn't seem like it's ever really addressed that much.
Yeah,
I mean, Carrie Mulligan, she actually is like 22 when she's playing this role.
But there's that
issue seems oddly like just kind of swept under the rug. The fact that he is having an affair that you find out at the very end, that is kind of the big reveal, and that's a big problem. But I don't know. In 1961, was it just like okay
that he was having an affair?
No, that he could possibly just pluck a high school student out and marry her.
Yeah,
you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I think maybe it was kind of. I mean, her parents don't seem to have a problem.
Yeah, they don't seem to have
a
problem.
But I wasn't around then, so I can't say with authority. And just one more thing about the affair. That kind of being tied to him being a criminal, I think it's just another bridge a little bit too far, where it's like, not only is it enough that she has to leave school 3 weeks, the fall from grace is there, like, oh, I don't know everything, okay, fine, but like, this guy is robbing people, and this is a pattern that he's had.
He's done this 10 other times. He's
and has had some kids
teenagers
with some of these teenagers also. So I think it lays it on a little bit thick, and that simplifies the conflict quite a bit.
Yeah, I agree. So can I go into a couple pieces of trivia?
Of course.
Here? Okay. Orlando Bloom dropped out. He was going to be Dominic Cooper's character.
Similar
role. How does he play that differently, you think?
Is that the friend? Dominic, is that Sarsgaard's buddy?
That's he's with Rosamund Pike's.
Yeah, it's a small enough role.
Yeah.
I guess that's why he turned it down, right?
Maybe.
He's like, I was Legolas.
So the nicknames, this is kind of...
Oh, yeah. Oh, man.
The most awkward, uncomfortable moments of the movie, maybe, like he's trying to seduce her and he's saying, I want you to call me Bubblebub. And you're Minnie. You're Minnie Mouse.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, this isn't what it's supposed to be like, you know? This isn't what the poetry made me think. The poetry made me think this would be more romantic. So Bubblebub is like so juvenile, infantile, really. But David is Jewish. It's possible that it was really the Yiddish word bubbla, which means honey or sweetie. I don't know if that makes it any better, but certainly in the movie, it sounds like he's saying Bubblebub. And
she calls him out on it. She says, no baby talk tonight.
Well, that's actually, that was kind of, I thought that was a good way to align kind of the audience with her point of view somewhat. Like the fact that she calls him out is, I think, it helps in that situation.
Yeah.
So anyway, Peter Sarsgaard, not only great in, I think, everything, a lot of things. he also runs 50 to 60 miles a week, you know, in his off time when he's not acting. So you got to love that.
Does he not own a couch? I don't understand.
Peter Sarsgaard is married to Maggie Gyllenhaal.
No, I didn't know that.
Carrie Mulligan is married to Marcus Mumford of Mumford and Sons.
Yeah, Rebecca informed me during the watch.
Excellent. Carrie Mulligan was considered for Lisbeth Salander in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo before Rooney Mara was cast. Pride and Prejudice, 2005, which I'm a big fan of. I know you are too. Keira Knightley, good in everything, Keira Knightley. I thought this was pretty funny though. She when they were filming Pride and Prejudice, the mother, Mrs. Bennett, who's played by Brenda Blethyn, she, as Carrie Mulligan said, she mummied us all. As you know, they're British. They say mum, you know, over there, across the pond, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And when they had days off, they went to a llama farm to, for bonding.
Llamas.
I love that. I think we could maybe record one of these shows one day at a llama farm just to kind of,
bonding. A little team building exercise.
Yeah, I like that.
That sounds good.
So keep it or kick it, Mike?
Our last of 2009, and it's one of many kicks
for me of
this year. I am kind of glad I rewatched it again, I guess, because Carrie Mulligan is really good.
She is.
And I love her in Promising Young Woman. And the movie looks really good.
It does. The shooting of it is great. I love, there's a couple shots that really stood out to me, like when she's looking out the window when he's going to like kick out somebody from his apartment, mm-hmm. from an apartment. And like you see her looking out of the car window, and there's like a reflection of that. And there's quite a few quite good shots in this movie, I thought.
And the BPGGIE, Peter Sarsgaard, is in it. So, I mean, there are definitely redeeming qualities. Will I seek this out a third time for a watch? Probably not. Two times is good.
I agree. I think I wish that the final third were a little more interesting.
Yeah.
But it's a pretty easy kick for me. So in our next episode, we'll talk about the year that was, 2009, wrap it up, reveal our top fives, which will not include An Education.
Will it include any of these movies that were, I feel like,
it
I
don't, might.
Have I kept any
you never
of these?
Know. I think The Hurt Locker, I think Avatar are contenders in my view.
Oof, Avatar.
I think Up in the Air is a contender.
Yeah.
I think Up is in consideration.
Yeah, yeah. Up is definitely
there
keepable.
You go. See, I told you, that's four movies right there that are probably,
I wouldn't keep Avatar, but until then, find us on social media and wherever you listen. And for nearly 20 years of Golden Takes, head over to
Letterboxd.com. Nearly 20 years. You were just saying 16 years last
episode.
Yeah,
I didn't want to just keep saying 16, 17.
And change it to 17.
Now it's 17. I'm just going to go nearly 20. I don't need to change it again.
For more than 15 years. That's a little, that'd be a little more accurate.
I guess so. Yeah.
Nearly, round it up. To support the show, visit patreon.com/bestpicturethis.
Thanks to WNZF and the illustrious Mark Gilliland for producing. Also, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe.
Thanks for listening to Best Picture This, where we always refuse to say bubble up.